This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Dr. Michael Stein does more than talk to his patients only about their physical health. He talks to them about their financial health, and the stories he hears are not only concerning, they're heartbreaking. So many are so desperately poor. There's a story about Perry, who's so broke he has to rinse off paper plates, or the man who's so stressed out he still talks to his mother, who's no longer alive. Dr. Stein shares these stories in a new book, Broke, Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. Dr. Stein is a professor of health law, policy, and management at Boston University, and he joins us now. Dr. Stein, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, let's begin with Perry. You clearly are taken with him because you returned to his story several times in Broke. And his story is the first you turn to in the book. In fact, the first sentence of the book is Perry saying, "I'm so broke, I have to rinse off paper plates." What did you find so interesting about his story?
Yeah, Perry is really the bridge over these many voices that make up this book. And Perry was a particularly moving person to me. He had had a career, he had had a difficult upbringing, and he had reached a point in his life where he was getting about $700 a month in Social Security check and another $150 in food stamps. So that's $870 a month. And, you know, just the thought of that and getting to know Perry over the years, how one lives on $870 a month, which so many Americans do at this point, was just eye-opening to me. And watching Perry over the year that he's followed in this book is just a remarkable journey. And it was not meant to be sort of sentimental. That is, you know, people who don't have enough money, what seems to not be enough money, are often have deep satisfactions in life. And Perry was one of them. So it's the resilience of people who have very little money that interested me, and Perry epitomized that.
I was going to say, one of the things he loves to do is help out his fellow residents in his apartment building. It sort of signals to me that he's broke, but he's got a heart. What does he do for his fellow residents?
He helps them. Usually people get often from federal funds or state funds. Those who are getting such monies often will get them in the beginning of the month. And by the end of the month, you've run through your little bit of money. And at that point, you go around borrowing. And if you live in large apartment complexes, as many people do, you sometimes will have a generous person in your midst who's able to hold aside some money and provide you with extra food or paying your pizza bill if it comes in. So he would do sort of those small gifts that were within his means to help the people around him that he could.
He's a big man, but his father was tough on him as a boy. What used to go on there?
Yeah, Perry was raised in a very difficult house. He had a mother who chased him around with a spoon, and he had to try to avoid being hit with that spoon, which led him eventually to become a boxer, which took him into the military, where he boxed in the military. He had been raised by a father who had drinking problems, and that was borne out on Perry's body as well. He had both parents basically led him to a beginning of his life as a fighter. And in some ways, he remains a fighter, you know, 50 years later.
One more thing really caught my eye about him. He's also an honest guy. He talks about a woman who apparently has mental health issues and once won the lottery. She gave Perry $10,000 before. What's he doing with that money?
Yeah, Perry was a man of great honor. And he treated this money handed to him as really something that was handed to him that he didn't deserve, and he returned the money. He eventually sort of held the money, sometimes was polite about it, sometimes gave it back, and she would continue to try to give him money, and he wouldn't accept it. So he felt that that was her money, and somebody in her life would use it better than he would, and he returned it.
Your heart clearly goes out to him.
Absolutely. I mean, I am just, and the book is filled with people
Yes.
whom I admire. I think some of them have a sort of stoic nonchalance about hardship, and some of them laugh at the world's attempts to break them, and some of them are broken, as the title says. But again, to me, sometimes the poor are doing just fine. You know, they love their work. They love solving problems. They love their families when they get home. They love their churches. They have faith. They don't necessarily concern themselves with their own potential. They might not want wealth or power or control. And I think that the lives just show the diversity of lives in America around us. I mean, remember, this is happening all over. I mean, your previous story that I was listening to as I came on didn't quite say this, but I'll just give you the numbers. 778,000 people lost their jobs last week in America, which is the highest ever. Before the pandemic highest was 695. We just broke that. So there are a lot of people who are losing jobs, losing money, and things are hard out there.
And you're seeing that in the patients who are coming to see you, the impact of COVID.
I absolutely see it. Now, the book was written primarily before COVID, when it was, it's very clear from anybody who's in public health like I am, or in the medical trenches like I am also, that health is shaped by the conditions of your life. And those conditions in America are generally shaped by your income and how much assets you have and the money that you have. I mean, if you look across the United States, the county in the United States that has the lowest mean income among the people who live there is in South Dakota. And the life expectancy of people in that county is 69 years, 67 years old. And if you look at the richest county in the United States, which is in Virginia, the life expectancy of the people in that county is 84 years old.
Wow.
So that's
Wow.
17 years difference between the poorest and the richest counties among us. I mean, that's just shocking. And poverty just infiltrates the lives of people.
Dr. Stein, some people might be wondering, hey, you're a medical doctor. How did you wind up getting so interested in the financial plight of your patients?
Yeah, that's a good question. And how do I have time to do it? And the answer is when people come in with strictly medical problems, immediate concerns, acute problems, I take care of them. And I don't talk about money. It's not as if I come into every visit and say, hello, how much money do you have? Right? These are generally people who I've gotten to know over time, and it becomes clear whether they ask me a specific financial question. Which interestingly, many people do. People will bring in, once you know them or once I know them, they will bring in bills and credit card bills and say, which ones should I pay off? Or I don't understand this about my taxes. So I end up talking about money with people who bring in financial issues. But I think there's also a clue about the hardships of people that doctors need to pay attention to over time as well. And so some of the behaviors that we see in offices and the doctors and other clinicians have trouble with are signs sometimes of not having enough money. And I'll give you an example. When people arrive late for appointments, they keep coming, but they always arrive late. Many offices around the country, offices of my friends, will turn them away. My office, which is filled with low-income people, we don't turn them away because I don't take that as a sign that they're disrespecting me. I'm trying to understand why it is that they're late. And for people who don't have money, that could mean the bus was late. It could mean their babysitter didn't arrive on time. It could be a number of issues. And so, either directly because they bring up money or indirectly because I start to see behaviors that may be markers of not having enough money, I end up talking about money with people that I know. And so I wrote down what they said.
I was going to say, and it turns out that medicine and people's financial status are pretty closely linked. I mean, it does come down to prescribing medication for some people, and the question becomes, can they afford the drugs to begin with?
That's a classically great question, Steve. Thanks for bringing that up. I mean, I try not to spend a lot of time on things like that in the book because it's so frequent, right? When people fail a set of antibiotics or a course of antibiotics, as we say in medicine, for a pneumonia or for an ear infection. It's sometimes because they never took the first antibiotic because you prescribed an antibiotic that wasn't covered by their insurance in a way that they could afford. And so the fact that people are non-adherent to medications, just like the fact that they're late for appointments, is sometimes a signal that, you know, there are other problems in their lives and that you need to pay attention to them in order to take care of them. Remember, I mean, chronic diseases are almost always a product of one's past. Acute problems are also become chronic problems because people aren't able to tend to them because of cost. And so, again, as you pointed out, missing medications is sort of the classic intersection of a medical problem and a social problem tied up.
Dr. Michael Stein is my guest. His new book, Broke, Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. He's a professor of health law, policy, and management out at Boston University. If you have questions for Dr. Stein, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. Stein, tell us a little more about your practice and where your office is located out there in Boston.
Yeah, my practice has been for years in Rhode Island, which is its own state, as you know, the smallest state. And really, I consider it a suburb of Boston. So it's about 45 minutes from Boston. I've had various sites, all inner city sites in Rhode Island. I've attracted a population of patients because of things that I've been interested in over the years, including HIV disease and addiction disease. But I see a broad spectrum of patients. And that's what I do. I work with a terrific group of people there.
I mean, why do you want to offer your services to the poor when I'm assuming you could make a lot more money elsewhere?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of people who are poor, and if you work in an inner city, they're going to walk in and somebody needs to take care of them. And I'm attracted to taking care of them. And, again, the medical issues that have been of interest to me, which are really sort of the epidemics of my lifetime, right? HIV disease and addiction are all around me. They are intellectually interesting to me. And so I see patients often who are without enough money.
I was going to say, how often do you see patients who have waited too long to come to see you because of that word you just used, which is money?
Very, very common. I mean, as you know, people who are poor come in late, afraid of getting bills, come in with more advanced disease, don't do as well because of that. A lot of these issues of poverty are, of course, reflected in our racial statistics because there's racial differences in income and assets in the United States and between poverty and race. You see bad outcomes in the United States. And compounded only by the fact that we also don't have universal health coverage. So many people have no money and come in without insurance. And I will actually see people without insurance in my office because I see many people with insurance. I will see people who I've had for a long time who lose their insurance. That happens very often in my office. And of course, I'm not going to reject them at that point. I know them and they come in. Regardless, and we have to make adjustments into medications and visit schedules if they really have no money. And it's fun in a certain way as a doctor because it brings back the old system of barter. People give me socks and candles. And in Rhode Island, they bring me clams. And so I'm always happy to barter for my services. They're not really that valuable.
Hey, how did you become interested in the plight of the poor? Because you write early in the introduction of the book that you weren't raised to know poverty intimately, at least the way you were raised out there.
Yeah, I don't think you can really know poverty. I've had parts of times in my life where I've certainly not had enough money and stayed in rundown places, but I had the potential in many ways and a bit of a net to get out of that. I'm never feeling that. You know, I really believe that poverty is something more than a sort of series of hardships because a lot of people have hardships. I mean, I do think that poverty really is a feeling. It really is. It's not just a number or an income level or a Medicaid threshold. It's really something that people inhabit, that affects every decision that they make including medical ones. And the feeling, as I describe it, is one of scarcity, mm-hmm. which is this feeling that you don't have enough of things. You don't have enough time, and you don't have enough space to make a mistake, and you certainly don't have enough money. And because of that, that takes a lot of mental bandwidth. So to just return to this idea of sort of missing or being late to appointments, to me, that is a sign of a person's bandwidth being limited. Again, I don't take it personally as a sign of disrespect. I see it as they live very much in the present when you don't have money, and it's not easy to solve problems. And that lack of bandwidth affects all sorts of things. And we can't have a profound misunderstanding about that, right? We can't believe that the person doesn't care. I mean, it's just a matter of humanity to believe that the person cares, and that we need as doctors to be interested and take care of people who care. And I presume that about everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think it has policy implications as well, which is, you know, when we set up policies across the United States that make people without money feel stigmatized, that make people with money fill out long forms of paperwork, these things that are these demands on people who have not enough bandwidth to begin with are really things that feel like punishment to people mm-hmm. who don't have money, and slow down their lives in ways that are, filled with hassles and complexity.
You know, you also get a sense reading these stories that one unexpected expense can sometimes topple over the entire apple cart.
Yes. So I'll tell you a story about somebody who I saw the other day. Here's a story of somebody who had some parking tickets. So he was lucky enough to have some cars. He had a series of parking tickets. His fines started to accumulate because he didn't have money to pay for his parking tickets. As you know, if you miss the due date, your fine doubles and then doubles again after a certain amount of time. Okay. So now he has lots of money in unpaid tickets. When you have lots of money in unpaid tickets in my state, your license can get suspended. Okay, so here he is. This guy is going to work. His license is suspended. He's still driving. Not great. Not a great idea. His taillight goes out. Doesn't even know his taillight goes out. He gets pulled over for a car taillight that's out. Oh, they run him. He's got a suspended license. Now his car is taken away. Okay, so he can't drive, which means he loses his job, which means he loses his health insurance. Yeah, yeah. He's lost his income. And this is the result of parking tickets. And so, that's the story of people in the world these days. It is just relentless and punishing.
Some of the other stories that caught my eye in here, there's a story, I'll even give you the page reference in case I'm throwing too many of them at you at once here. Page 24 here, Doctor. This is titled Knowing the Routine. It's about an ex-wife who embezzled from the Girl Scouts, and yet she works at a bank. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was the story. And again, these are stories where sometimes I'll flip the gender of people. So again, these are always hidden in certain ways. I don't tell ages. I don't tell genders in general of people.
Because you got patient doctor privilege to worry about here.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really don't talk about medical problems very much in the book. Again, because I want these people to be disguised. I've also asked all of them if I could write about them. So but this was a person who just happened to be embezzling, and it had happened before. And it was a story about their spouse who came in and told me this story, and the moments of having to tell their children that their parent was going to be arrested, and what that meant. So it was just a touching story. And the stories in the book, you know, again, are these sort of shards of conversation that I have with people. And doesn't give a sort of final result of what happens to that family when the woman was arrested, but gives you a sense that, you know, these things related to money enter my office in all sorts of ways.
I was going to say, a lot of these stories are vignettes, very, very short. In fact, there's one on page 19. It's a story, it's two sentences long, and it's titled Half Smile, and it has to do with dentures, Doctor. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, the two sentences are, I got all the bottom teeth pulled. That was covered by insurance, but I don't know if dentures to replace them are.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is an entire story of this person, right? Who's just worried that what are they going to do about the fact that they have no teeth now, and they don't even know what can be covered. You know, teeth are a signal of social class in America, and mm-hmm. there are a number of stories in here about teeth and the problems with finding a dentist, getting a dentist to do the work, having the money to pay that dentist, having the dentist do half a job because you only have half the money available. There's a lot of teeth stories. There are a lot of car stories because we're a nation of cars, and cars breaking down, as I told you in the parking ticket example, is a common occurrence in my practice.
Doctor, let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Tony from Prairie Village on the Kansas side. Tony, good morning. Nice to have you.
Hey, good morning. Nice to have you too. Thanks very much for taking the call.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Dr. Stein, thank you very much for being on the show this morning. My question is around doctors. My doctor I go to sometimes wants to provide high level of care, but is sometimes disconnected from what it costs me as a patient. Why do you think that is, that doctors are disconnected from what it costs a patient who may not be able to afford the care he wants to provide?
It's a great question, Tony. Thank you.
Great question. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is they're typically not trained in costs. Second, they're not encouraged during their training to ask about costs and to think about costs. Third is most doctors will see only insured patients, and they will assume that the costs are covered, which of course, as you know, as a patient, and most Americans know, and increasingly so, are uncovered. Even if you have medical insurance, costs are uncovered. And I would say fourth, many doctors, certainly young doctors, if this was a young doctor, have generally been healthy and haven't incurred medical costs yet, and so are blind to this unless they've sort of had a parent live through it and looked at medical bills. Doctors are completely divorced from the medical billing system. In fact, doctors will not see money in the office, right? I mean, I write about this in the book, how really in all of my years, you know, I've never exchanged money with a patient. They've never handed me money. They've handed me, as I said, clams and socks, but not money. But they, I don't see money when there are co-pays that goes into a staff person at the front of my office. So it's a strangely money sterile environment that doctors walk into and live in. And I think it's unfortunate and a deficit in our training. And I hope that partly explains what you're asking.
I was going to say, you call that a hole in the training of young doctors, that there's this idea that they don't know anything about the social drivers that wind up making people stressed out and sick and in your office to begin with.
No, I think that that's true. And doctors are often sort of routinized and work habitually. So if you looked at, for instance, the MRI scanning test, that is the sort of specialized X-ray test, in any city, right? There are going to be 10 places that 10 facilities, 10 radiology facilities that service that MRI. And a doctor will typically send patient number one to facility A because that's where they send everybody to, facility A. And that doctor has never done the research. And then it requires the patient to do the research to understand that MRI facility B actually would offer the same test with less money. And so how does that happen? Somebody's got to do that research in order to send that patient to the lower cost and equally efficacious MRI facility. But the doctors aren't doing that extra work, and you'd hope that the patients would do the work. Sometimes the insurance company does the work, and sometimes they don't. So a lot of doctoring, unfortunately, works sort of as reflexive, and I think that happens too often around these financial issues.
What do you hope this book does ultimately, Doctor?
I just hope that people recognize that there are a lot of poor people among us. That's one thing, that you know, we live in a country where one out of six children lives in poverty. That was before COVID, one out of six children in America. That is a rate that is absolutely unique among our peer nations. So whatever people can do locally or more widely, I think it's important to both be respectful across the board to people who have money and don't have money, which is sort of in keeping with our religious ethics. Mm-hmm. I would say that's number one. I do think Americans are very generous. We're probably the most generous nation in the world. 7 out of 10 households give money away or volunteer and give services. So we're a very generous nation. I think we can be a little bit more generous. And I do think we need to poke at our policies, because our policies, these are not just individual issues. My book, written from a doctor's office, makes it seem like these things are very individual, but we live in a country with policies that can fix many of these things. If you wanted to reduce our absolutely miserable and immoral rate of child poverty, there are very clear things that we know work and that we need to push our politicians to do. So policies are very important, and particularly at this moment when more and more people are unemployed and without incomes.
The book is Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. It's a quick read. It's a good read. The author is Dr. Michael Stein. He's a professor out at Boston University. Michael, I really enjoyed the book. Appreciate the insights that you provide all of us with all this. And thanks for your time today.
I'm honored to have been here. Thanks for having me.
After a short break, when we come back, we're going to turn and change subjects radically. We're going to talk about the TV show Fargo that's based in Kansas City, but how true to form, how true to life is it actually? I'm Steve Kraske. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3.